How do you full screen this? Can you full screen this? Okay, there we go. Cool. Okay, so this is part two. We did part one last Monday. So we're just going to pick up where we left off. Okay, cool. So yeah, last Monday we covered parallel ray tracing and we went over some basics of the rendering equation and BRDFs and stuff. Today we're going to look at distributed ray tracing, which is a variant that allows for a lot of cool features and lays the groundwork for path tracing. And then we're also going to look at BRDFs in more detail. We're going to look at Monte Carlo integration, and then we'll look at path tracing in more detail, how that relates to the distributed ray tracing stuff. And then if we have time, we'll cover stackless KDE. We'll go into special acceleration structures, and then we'll look at stackless KDE trees. And that may overflow, though, if that's OK with Patrick.
If it overflows next week, it's fine.
OK, yeah. So if that happens, we'll just have to have part three of two. OK, so distributed ray tracing. This is a really cool image. It's called the 1984 image because it's rendered in 1984. But even though it's from, you know, really early on, it has all these cool effects that we associate with modern renderers. It's got soft shadows, it's got motion blur, it's got glossy reflections, all sorts of cool stuff. And it's because they were able to do all of this because they invented this algorithm called distributed ray tracing. Okay, so what is distributed ray tracing? We'll start by looking at an example. Can anybody tell me what is wrong with this picture? There's an area light, and then an occluder, and then a shadow. No soft shadows, right? Yeah, we have no soft shadows in the way of an area light. So we expect it to look more like that, right? Okay, so how do we accomplish this effect? And some of you guys actually implemented this in the homework, so this should be familiar. Okay, so we use a method called distributed ray tracing. And the basic idea behind distributed ray tracing is that instead of casting one ray per pixel into the scene and then tracing it and calling that the end of that pixel, we oversample each pixel. We send multiple rays into that pixel. And we jitter those rays over some properties so that we can sample, you know, we can sample more than one point in this property. So use cases for this are anti-aliasing through super sampling, soft shadows, motion blur, depth of field, glossy, non-perfect specular reflections. And then later on, we're going to see that a lot of BRDF stuff depends on this idea of distributed ray tracing, being able to take multiple samples per pixel. So an example, you know, the simplest example of distributed ray tracing is supersampled anti-aliasing. We shoot stuff, we shoot rays through a pixel and we jitter each ray's location inside of the pixel. And you can think of that as kind of integrating over a smooth surface. So the reason that we get aliasing is because surfaces in real life are smooth, but when we render them on a pixel grid, we have to discretize the world, and you know, discretization inherently is not smooth. So instead, if we can integrate over that smooth surface for each pixel point, we can get a value that is sort of a weighted average of multiple points in reality, and that results in a smoother image. And there's two ways that we can do this super sampling. We can either use a pre-computed fixed sampling pattern, or we can generate random samples on the fly and then average the result. So the fixed sampling pattern method, the idea behind it is, okay, instead of spending a lot of compute calculating new random points on the fly, we'll just store a list of random points in some pattern. And every time that we need to do multiple sampling on a pixel, we'll just look up this pattern, and each ray will go to a different point in this pattern. And there's various patterns that have been developed. There's a fixed uniform grid. There's Poisson disk, just random. There's a rotated uniform grid, which is the fixed uniform grid, just off-axis. And the advantage of this is that it saves computation time, like mentioned. But the disadvantage is that it can produce artifacting and banding issues, depending on, you know, what the scene actually looks like and what your sampling pattern is like, because it's not really truly random, so it doesn't get a true, full representation of what's going on within a single pixel. However, On the GPU, we don't really care if this requires more compute, right? Because on the GPU, we've got plenty of compute. We also don't like caching, so, you know, when we don't have to. So on the GPU, it makes more sense to just generate these points on the fly sometimes, most of the time. So if we think about it, super sampled anti-aliasing, like mentioned, is just integrating over all possible points on a smooth curved surface in order to produce a result that looks closer to what reality is. So distributed ray tracing can be extended to other effects by simply changing what you're integrating over. So for example, motion blur, we just integrate over time. Instead of jittering our rays, you know, inside of the pixel, we jitter them across time. So the first ray will sample the scene at time 0. The second ray will sample it at time 0.1. And the third ray will sample it at time point, you know, negative 1, and so on and so forth. And because of that, we can sample where objects are at multiple locations in time instead of at a single fixed point. And we can get nice motion blurred images like this. Sorry, was the... Okay. Depth of field is another really straightforward, simple application. So if you think about how most of our ray traces are implemented from 460 and 560, we shoot all of our rays from a single point through an image grid, which is effectively the same as using a pinhole camera. But real cameras have lenses, and they have sensors that are more than just, you know, a single point in space. It's an actual two-dimensional surface. And so depending on where rays begin on that sensor and how, and what point on the lens they go through and how they refract through that lens, they'll enter the scene in a different way. And because of that, we're going to get, you know, that's where like depth of field arises from. We get something called the circle of confusion, which the basic idea is you have a lens, and then you shoot out your rays from the camera. And they refract, right? So when your rays cross over like this, this is where your blurring starts to happen, and it's called the circle of confusion. And as you can see, when you move this camera back to here, the angle that they're hitting that lens at is going to change, which changes where this point will occur, somewhere here. So the way that we can approximate that effect with distributed ray tracing is we just jitter the camera's position. We just slide it back and forth for each ray. That's one possible approach. If you were really crazy, you could actually, you know, do some kind of thing where you integrate over a circular aperture and you integrate over a lens, but this works fine for our purposes.
So to what extent should we jitter the camera's position for...
Oh, that's a really good question. So how much of a depth of field effect you get is directly dependent on how much you are... like what the interval that you're jittering that camera over is. So if it's a really short distance, then most of your rays are going to be like falling within the same focus area. And so your image will be more focused. But if you pull that distance out longer, you'll get a more blurry image.
And what directions do you jitter? Left, right, back, forward?
Oh, sorry. That's another good question. You slide it along the normal of the image plane. So if this is the image plane, and this is your camera, you're moving it like this. You can also choose to play with it going in other ways, but...
I think you'll get a motion blur if you move it that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, if you move it that way, you'll get a motion blur.
You
or you'll get like a... almost like a... you might be able to get almost like a barrel distortion
like
kind of effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the ray equation, which is P, H, V, and SX, and SY, you just change P.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, from the point of view of implementation, like, I'm not sure how much I should move. Should it depend on the distance of the eye from the scene currently? I mean, the distance by which we should jitter it, does it depend on the distance?
There's a number of factors that play into it. How far your camera is from your image plane, how much you're moving it, how far your scene is from the image plane. All of that will impact like what the final depth of field will look like.
So it should be adaptive, not fixed, like say some.
Yeah. It's generally good to
control it.
Hmm?
I think it would be best if you could control it somehow.
Yeah, it's usually it's an attribute that you would let the user set. and play with and figure out.
So it's not a bad idea to add some keyboard controls to your app and then tweak it.
Yeah, this is why all of the like optional pick two features, all of those features are recommended because they're useful in some fashion. And like Patrick said, the interactive camera is really useful for things like that. Okay, so soft shadows, this one you guys are all familiar with. We're just integrating over a light source. you can think of an area light as just an infinite number of point lights covering this area, this piece of geometry, and they're casting an infinite number of shadows. They're all really close to each other, but slightly off of each other. And this is where this soft shadowing is coming from. So in a distributed ray tracer, for each shadow feeler that we send out to the light source, we, instead of sending it to, you know, sending all shadow feelers to a single point, when we send a shadow feeler, we pick a random point that's on that area light, and then we send it there, and we repeat this process over and over and over, and we accumulate all of these results, and eventually you get nice soft shadows from averaging these results. And then, sorry.
So later in the semester, we're going to look at doing soft shadows in a rasterization pipeline, and you're going to see how it's like a giant hack compared to this.
Yeah, the nice thing about ray tracing methods is that since it's more like physically based, you get a lot of effects without having to do, you know, sort of tricky, hacky stuff. But then, as we'll find out with rasterization, rasterization can be really, really fast. Okay, so shading. Shading is interesting because you can almost consider it as integrating over BRDF, integrating over all the different possible ray directions that can, or ray reflection directions that can happen with a surface given its BRDF property, right? So as we mentioned last time, a BRDF, you can basically think of it as a function that defines how a ray will leave a surface given what direction it came into the surface and what the normal of that intersection is. So, you know, a really simple example of a BRDF is perfect reflection, right? Each incoming ray will always have the same outgoing ray for every single sample, and that's where you get perfect mirror surfaces. And that's an example, perfect mirror surface. So every single ray that's hitting that dragon, the angle that it reflects often will never change. So you can super sample that pixel as much as you want, but every single ray that you shoot through that pixel, when it hits that same point on the dragon, it'll reflect off in the same direction that every other ray has. So what if we have BRDF that across samples doesn't return the same result, right? What if, you know, it returns a random result? Okay, so a good example case of this is glass. So glass both refracts and reflects. Oh, sorry, I should mention that in this case, we can shoot a single ray, and we can shoot a single ray and basically sample the entire BRDF, because we know the result is always going to be the same. So the result of accumulating 50 rays shooting against a perfectly reflective surface is going to be the same as if we shoot a single ray against it, right? However, in the case of glass, real glass both reflects and refracts. So rays that hit the glass surface have two possible outgoing directions. They can either reflect off or they can refract through it. And so we need to consider two different functions when we consider surfaces like glass. We have the BRDF, which defines the reflection, and then we have a new thing called the BTDF, the bidirectional transmission distribution function. It's the same as the BRDF, but it just defines how a ray will transmit through a medium instead of reflecting off of it. And then the BRDF plus the BTDF, we call that the BSDF, which is the bidirectional scattering distribution function. And this is a glass dragon that, you know, you can see there's refraction, rays are going through it, but there's also reflection, like all these little green parts and red reflections and highlights and stuff. So to implement a BSDF, we have to send multiple rays from a pixel to sample the BSDF. We have to use distributed ray tracing again. So in the glass case, when each ray hits a glass surface, we'll randomly choose whether that ray reflects or refracts. It's just totally random. It's called Russian roulette. And we'll accumulate the result of multiple, you know, samples against this. So about half, over a sufficient number of samples, about half of our rays will refract through it, about half of them will reflect off of it. And then we average the result, and that gives us our final look for the glass. And then we can change how shiny or how clear the glass is by simply changing that probability distribution. So you can weight the probability so that, 60% of the rays will refract, or only 40% will refract, or whatever it is. So go ahead.
Yeah. Do you consider total reflection when it's transmitting from the glass outside to the air? When it's over the critical angle?
Yeah, all of that is sort of extra stuff that you implement within the BTDF itself on how it reacts, and your index of refraction and your Fresnel reflection, all of that is part of the BSDF and is part of the BRDF and the BTDF. But in the end, how you sample them is still just by randomly choosing. So diffuse surfaces are a weird case. So the way that we handle diffuse surfaces in our traditional ray tracer is really simple, right? We hit a diffuse surface, we send out a shadow fielder, and we're done. So diffuse surfaces in reality are kind of an oddball case because they're actually reflective, but they're also microfaceted, and the microfacets send out the reflections in basically uniformly in every single direction. And the result of that is that we don't have a uniform reflection. It's completely scattered. And the result is we get something that looks like it's not reflecting. we can simulate this property by using distributed ray tracing again. We can send in multiple rays, and for each ray, we just pick a random direction inside of a hemisphere, and we send it off in that direction, and we accumulate the result, and you get a diffuse surface that doesn't have reflections. This is something that will become very important in path tracing later on. Okay, so what if we change the probability distribution from being totally random within a hemisphere to something that favors a certain direction, right? So if we have, a surface, instead of sending stuff out, inside of a hemisphere, what if our distribution looks more like that? So a couple of rays go out here, but the vast majority of them go out in this direction. Does anybody know what that produces?
Bias.
Well, yes, but in this case it's a bias that we're intentionally creating because we want the effect that it produces. Okay, so the effect that it produces is glossy surfaces, like surfaces that are not purely diffuse but not purely reflective either, right? So kind of like plastic or things like that. If we modify the diffuse case to use a biased probability distribution function, we get glossy surfaces. And then subsurface scattering is a sort of a really extreme, complex case. And so subsurface scattering describes how light interacts with translucent objects, objects that are not purely refractive, but not purely diffuse either. So light will enter a subsurface scatter like material, light will enter the surface, it'll scatter multiple times randomly within that surface, and then it'll exit at a different point from which it entered. So this is a fancy render of a subsurface scattering dragon. It was created with Arion Render, which incidentally is a GPU path tracer. So some examples of subsurface scattering materials are milk, skin, marble, wax, anything that has some like translucency. And you can usually see this effect strongest when you put a light behind a subsurface scattering material, because you'll see different amounts of light coming through depending on the thickness of the material at different points. So this little diagram shows it pretty well. For a BSSRDF, bidirectional subsurface scattering reflectance distribution function, it's kind of a mouthful. A ray will come in, it'll go off in some random angle for some random direction within the material, then it'll go off in another random angle with a random distance, and then another random angle, random distance, and so on and so forth until it eventually exits the surface. So this is the physically correct brute force way to approach subsurface scattering. And it can be really computationally expensive since it's highly non-deterministic. You don't really know what's going to happen when you send something in and you randomly scatter it. So a lot of distributed ray tracing is required. This can require, you know, hundreds to thousands of samples to look right. Okay. Yeah.
Going back to the last slide.
Mm-hmm.
You see, like, when you scatter the one that's going through it, are you mm-hmm. deciding to not let it go all the way through and scatter it again before it goes off?
Yeah, you are choosing an attenuation distance, a distance after which the ray will stop,
okay.
and then pick a new direction. And each time that you scatter it, you're picking, along with the angle, you're also picking a distance that the ray will travel. And that directly affects, like, sort of how translucent the material looks. So, for example, milk would probably have, like, a longer scattering distance than, like, frosted glass or something. Okay, so the basic point of all of this is that, like, fundamentally distributed ray tracing simply means we cast multiple rays to evaluate properties that can't really be evaluated correctly with a single sample. So, as we have seen from sort of from all the examples that we've gone through, and especially from the BRDF evaluations, the runtime for distributed ray tracing can be highly non-deterministic. So once again, in this case, we have no idea when all of our rays are going to come back, and we have no idea how many rays we're going to need for a good solution. So this means that if we choose to implement distributed ray tracing in a massively parallel fashion on the GPU, if we choose to parallelize it by ray paths or by pixels, we're going to be wasting a lot of compute power. So this is sort of like the problem that was mentioned last week with the ray tracing and parallelizing by rays versus parallelizing by pixels, only now it's even worse because at least in ray tracing, you have a fairly deterministic algorithm and you can be fairly certain when it's finished, right? But in distributed ray tracing, that's no longer true. There's a potential for us to have, you know, one thread which finishes immediately and one thread that goes on for like a gazillion different scattering points and whatever before it finally finishes. So this is why in Project 2 you guys are required to do the ray parallelization. Okay, so now that we have ray tracing and we have distributed ray tracing and we've gone over BRDFs, we have most of the foundational groundwork to go over global illumination and figure out how to build a path tracer that can simulate global illumination. Okay, so what is global illumination? So global illumination refers to a complete lighting solution that incorporates both indirect lighting within the scene and direct lighting within the scene, or indirect illumination, direct illumination. So basically, global illumination is what the rendering equation we looked at last class describes. So as you can see, this is the sample render from Project 1, from the ray tracer, and it's direct illumination only. So you get these really, really dark shadows in all of these areas that are not in direct line of sight of the light source. So that's without GI. And then when you add global illumination, you get an image that looks more like that. So these dark areas are a lot brighter because they're still not receiving light directly from the light source, but instead they're receiving light from all the walls and all the other objects. Because light, when it hits a surface, it doesn't actually fully absorb. It'll bounce off of that surface and then go off in a new direction. Like some percentage of it will. So that's basically what global illumination describes. It describes both the direct lighting and also the light that areas are accumulating from light that's bouncing off of other objects. And then global illumination, so generally global illumination encompasses effects like diffuse color bleeding, reflective and refractive caustics, volume scattering, like all these things that you cannot get as a direct result of direct lighting. And you can see that in this image. Or at least in this pair of images. So the image on the left is without GI, and it does have an ambient light, which is why this back area isn't totally black. But without the ambient light, that would be totally black. And there's no caustics on the walls, there's no color bleeding. Areas that are not in direct line of sight of the light are undefined. And then if we look at the image with global illumination, areas that are not in direct line of sight of the light. They're still lit. There's color bleeding going on. Like, there's a green, there should be a green wall over here, but I guess it's not in view of the camera. And that green wall is casting light onto the white wall in the sort of alcove in the back. So that's where all that green color bleeding is coming from. And as you can see, the glass balls are casting caustics onto the floor and onto the walls. So we get all these nice effects that you would expect to see in real life.
So, Carl, one thing I want to say is, you know, you mentioned that there's an ambient light source in the left-hand scene. And something I know Norm says a lot in 460 and 560 is that ambient, although it's like widely used, it was widely used in real-time rendering, and it still is to some extent, it's a total fudge factor because we're not doing global illumination. It's like, we're not taking into account light bouncing around, so we're just going to say that it's this much light.
Yeah, ambient light doesn't really exist in real life, because if you think about how we implement ambient light, we treat it as, hey, there's just light magically coming from nowhere or everywhere, but that's clearly not true. Okay, so since we went over distributed ray tracing, and we went over ray tracing, and we went over BRDFs and stuff like that, we have almost all of the pieces we need to implement global illumination. We're just missing one last piece. So, in order to generate an image with global illumination, we need to solve the rendering equation from last week, right? So unfortunately, that equation turns out to be one of those equations that is impossible to solve analytically. We can't just work it out on paper and solve it. Instead, in order to solve a global illumination type problem, we have to consider all the light that's incoming from every single direction for a given point, and we have to figure out a way to gather all that light and come up with a color value based off of that. So we're not going to go too far into like the probability math and stuff behind Monte Carlo integration, because that's kind of both beyond the scope of this class and not directly relevant to implementing it. All you guys need to know is that Monte Carlo integration refers to a group of numerical techniques where you can approximate a proper solution to a function through repeated random sampling. And the more random sampling you do, the closer your approximation will converge to the actual solution. So in distributed ray tracing, it's sort of Monte Carlo-esque in that we are converging on a proper representation of some type of phenomenon by repeatedly sampling like the entire probability distribution that phenomenon exists over. So if you think about, you know, the supersampled anti-aliasing, where if you think about the supersampled anti-aliasing within a pixel, there's a probability that each point inside of that pixel contributes some sort of useful piece of information. And we're figuring out just what that final pixel needs to look like by randomly sampling. And over time, the more samples we have, the better of a approximation we have of that final pixel value. And the same is with, you know, the BRDFs and the area lights and stuff like that. So that's why when you run distributed ray tracing, if you have a low number of samples, you'll have a lot of noise. And then the more samples you add, the smoother your image gets, because your image is getting closer and closer to the accurate final solution. And then eventually, if you have enough samples, you'll have something that is more or less the right solution. So Monte Carlo integration turns out to be really, really expensive for the same reason that distributed ray tracing is really, really expensive. You need a lot of samples in order to arrive at a usable solution. So the funny thing about Monte Carlo sampling, though, is that each sample that you're taking has to be independent from all the other samples you're taking, right? Otherwise, you've biased your even probability, and it's not really random anymore. Okay, so if every single sample is computationally independent from all the other samples, that implies that Monte Carlo techniques have a tendency to be massively, embarrassingly parallel. So what does that imply about Monte Carlo techniques on the GPU?
It's
should be really easy for us to do, right? So this is kind of a tongue-in-cheek example. Oftentimes, you know, different scientific fields that use Monte Carlo techniques, when they choose to implement these techniques on the CPU, they find themselves in need of massive supercomputers. And then when you choose to implement it as a CUDA or an OpenCL kernel, oftentimes you can find that, hey, a couple of graphics cards or even a single graphics card is enough for you to do your work. So how do we implement a Monte Carlo technique to calculate a global illumination solution? How do we sample all of the possible incoming light for a given point and come up with a final pixel value based off of that? So there's a variety of techniques to do this, but the sort of first and original technique and also the sort of best unbiased approach is path tracing. So path tracing is it's a brute force solution to the global illumination problem because it simply relies on sampling this, you know, all incoming light as much as possible and arrive at a final solution. So it was originally proposed in 1996 by Kajaya inside of his paper that also proposed the rendering equation, but it hasn't really fully been implemented until in the past couple of years because it's so computationally expensive on the CPU. And also because, you know, you can view path tracing as kind of distributed ray tracing taken to its absurd logical extreme. Instead of like 5 samples per pixel, we're going to take a gazillion. And, you know, instead of using distributed ray tracing to get this one phenomenon, we're going to use this sort of highly distributed ray tracing technique to get all phenomenon and all lighting and stuff like that. So the path tracing algorithm is actually a lot simpler than the ray tracing algorithm. We start off by shooting a ray into the scene. For each ray, we follow where it goes into the scene and what surface it hits. Upon hitting a surface, we figure out the emittance of that surface, or basically how bright it is, if it's a light source or not. And we figure out the direction the ray will go off into based on the BRDF. And then we send the ray off in that new direction. We accumulate the emittance and the color of the material that we hit. And we just continue doing this over and over again until some recursion depth that we define is, you know, satisfied.
What are the stopping conditions?
Okay, so the stopping conditions are either the ray has to hit a light source, at which point we finish tracing that ray because, you know, we've hit a light source, there's no point in going further, or we hit some maximum recursion depth that we define ahead of time, so 10 bounces or 20 bounces or whatever. And yeah, we repeat this over and over again.
So there's no stopping condition for diffuse surfaces,
Yeah, that's a key difference between path tracing and ray tracing is that there's no such thing as a shadow feeler. There's no concept of hitting a diffuse surface, doing a shadow feeler, and calling it done. When we hit a diffuse surface, we treat it like the physical case where it actually results in more scatter. So when we hit a diffuse surface, we just scatter it off in a totally random direction inside of a hemisphere over that surface, and then we continue tracing.
So Carl, you're saying the soft shadows just come for free.
Yeah, so the wonderful thing about path tracing is that soft shadows come for free. Global illumination comes for free. If you add, you know, jittering and you add, if you add various types of jittering, you can get your motion blur, your anti-aliasing, your depth of field, all that stuff just is sort of built into the computation. It's compute that you have to do anyway. So if you add in all those other distributed effects, the cost is already built in. So you get them for free.
So we don't send a shadow feeler as we do in ray tracing?
No.
Do we have to differentiate between a reflective surface or a Lambertian surface?
No, so there's no longer any distinction between, there's no longer special cases for surfaces. Instead, each surface just has a BRDF function that's redundant, and each surface has a BRDF attached to it that defines how the ray is going to go off. So in the diffuse case, right, the BRDF would just return, okay, ray goes off in random direction. In the perfectly reflective case, the BRDF would just return, okay, you're going off always in this direction. Or you're always going off at this angle always.
So So for then for reflective surface, do we just shoot one ray or multiple rays even for a reflective surface?
You are shooting multiple rays for everything because you, yeah, be, well, hopefully it'll become more clear once we go over what the pseudocode looks like. And we can work it out on the board as well, like with a visual example. So the pseudocode, this is actually a lot simpler than the ray tracing pseudocode as well. So given, you know, a ray, your list of objects, your list of light sources, and some maximum recursion depth, you shoot a ray into the scene, you determine its nearest intersection, just like in ray tracing. If it doesn't hit anything, you turn black, you're done. If it does hit an object, you test if the object is a light source. If it is, you return the emittance of that light source. So just the color and the brightness multiplied by each other. If it's not a light source, you figure out what the new ray direction is based on the BSDF of that, of the material that that object has.
Carl, could you explain that? That's not, so it is random or it is not random? The direction of this?
The BSDF? Or the direction of the secondary ray.
Right.
So the direction of the second ray will or will not be random dependent on what type of material it hits. So in a perfect, if you have a perfectly reflective room, then yes, all of your rays will always go off in the same direction on the second bounce. But if you have a room full of diffuse surfaces, since each diffuse surface sends off its rays in a random direction, then you don't actually know where the second bounce is actually going to go. It's random and different each time. Yeah, that's a really good point. And you get all of that from the BSDF, and then you return the material color of the object that you hit times the color that you get from recursing on the path trace function. So this is for one sample. This is for one, like, you know, for one pixel, you shoot one sample, and this is how you deal with one sample. And then we need to, that's not. Okay, so we have, since we have to accumulate random samples and take an average, we have to wrap this all up in something called accumulate. And accumulate just takes in the number of iterations you want. The number of iterations is the same idea as like the number of samples per pixel. And then you just loop. You just keep on calling path trace over and over again, and you just add up the results of all those calls to path trace. And then you can divide it by the number of iterations, and that is your final pixel color. So I guess we can work through a really simple like diagram. Okay, so say we have a camera, and you know we have a sphere inside of a box. This is a side view, and this is our light source. So in our first iteration, we'll send in a ray into the scene through a pixel, and it'll hit this diffuse sphere. And it goes off in a random direction because it's a diffuse sphere. So let's say it goes off here. And this is a diffuse floor. Okay, so random direction. Diffuse wall again. Everything is diffuse in this case. Goes off in a random direction. And it hits the light source. And this is where we terminate. And we return basically the brightness of that light source times this color times this color times this color. Okay, so that's our first iteration and we're done. So then we do our second iteration, send in the same ray cast from the camera. This time it goes off out into space. Okay, we return black, didn't hit anything. And that's where our variance, like all that noise that we're getting is coming from. Every time that you have, when you get noise like this, it's because you're having, it's because the majority of the samples that you're shooting into that pixel are going off into space and returning, you know, color information that's not useful. Yep.
In the first bounce case, when you hit the light source, are you also taking into account, in standard diffuse lighting, you would say, you know, with the shadow feeler, you'd say, I'm at this angle, take cosine of it, multiply it by that. Are you using any sort of those factors, or is that implicit in the VRDF?
That's sort of implicit. You don't have to do any of that, like weird cosine hacking and stuff like that.
You're just multiplying the light source's color and intensity by all the colors that you hit
Yeah.
So, do we always terminate the ray if it hits the light source? Because the light has both emittance component and it can also reflect some other light. So, we should consider both ray.
Okay, so that is true, but for all intents and purposes, you don't have to consider it, because usually the emittance of a light source will greatly overwhelm any reflectance that is coming off of it. Because usually the reflectance off of an object is only a percentage of the original intensity of the light that it's originating from, whereas a light source is, you know, it's full intensity, so it washes out everything. I'd be curious to see someone implement that, though, and see what kind of results they get.
Don't you reduce the emittance on each box?
I think because we are multiplying, it will anyway reduce, right? Like,
yeah.
Assume the light is white and the surface is, say, like, green, so all the other components would become
yeah.
zero anyway.
Yeah. Like, that reduction is happening in your multiplication. Yeah, second ray goes off into space, and you know, we just keep doing this, and with each bounce that we have, the path that we're getting can be totally different. But over time, it'll average out to the proper solution.
Does everyone see how you get color bleeding and GI just implicitly in doing this, just by looking at the paths that are choice here?
Yeah. Because when you have a path that's like, you know, this and going off here, since path tracing is actually running backwards of what photons are actually doing, what's happening is the photon is starting out from here. It's hitting off of this surface and carrying the color of the surface with it, hitting this surface, carrying its color, and then hitting the surface, carrying its color, and finally going into the camera. And that's where our color bleeding is coming from, and that's also where our indirect illumination is coming from. And whenever, you know, as you, and we're getting soft shadows from the fact that rays that hit this point, this object is in their way. So inside of their random distribution, this entire part of that distribution is now cut off from ever hitting the light source. So that's where all of our soft shadowing is coming from.
I have a question about the implementation of this. If you go to the next slide,
mm-hmm.
the accumulation loop, would that be in the CUDA ray trace core, or would that be the function that calls the CUDA ray trace core?
Okay, so this depends on whether you are parallelizing. There's like now another layer that you can parallelize. It's just like parallelizing layers all the way down. So at the lowest, we can parallelize by ray.
Yeah.
And then in ray tracing, we can parallelize by ray path. And then in path tracing, you can also parallelize not only by ray path, but by all samples for a pixel. So now there's a difference between parallelizing by ray path and parallelizing by pixel. If you parallelize by pixel, then a single kernel is doing all of the samples and all of the ray paths for that single pixel before it returns. So there's three levels you can parallelize at, and as usual, the bottom layer, the ray level parallelization, that's still the best one. Because if you think about, you know, wasting time between ray paths and then wasting time between groups of ray paths, yeah.
So let me ask a question. What if you guys had one pixel processed by a kernel, so you say you have 20 samples in there? What do you think will happen in terms of branches? They're likely to diverge a lot, right? Because
yeah.
these directions, especially if there's few surfaces all random, and you're going to have a bunch of, you know, you're going to be looping through your scene, seeing what rays and what objects, and they're going to diverge consistently.
Sorry, was that a question from you or for them?
Oh, no, I was just stating.
Oh, okay.
I'll ask my question because, when we exit CUDA ray trace core, we actually delete the color. So, how are we going to accumulate color if it's not in CUDA ray trace core? We kind of have to store it somewhere and pass it back to the CPU, right?
So, what you can... that is one option. Another option is that you can store it within CUDA ray trace core itself and have it launch multiple kernels and accumulate the results of multiple kernel launches within itself.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, to your point, yes, branch divergence is going to be a severe problem inside of path tracing, especially when you have, mostly it actually happens within this evaluate BSDF, because the BSDF is, you know, where all your different, you have a whole bunch of different possible interactions, and you have to figure out which one. And usually that, in the most naive implementation, that takes the form of a giant branching statement. If you're using like CUDA 4 and you're on like a fancy Fermi graphics card, you could potentially play with using function pointers as a way to get around that. So passing a function pointer along with the material and then only calling the function that that function pointer points at. That's something that I myself have not experimented with though. But once again, if anybody wants to try, you're more than welcome to.
Yeah, and we explicitly say in the README for the project, but you know, we propose features, but we also say you're welcome to propose your own. And so a feature can be an optimization or you know, an architectural change like that too. So you know, run with the, we try to make these kind of open-ended so you can play to your interest and to your strengths. So please, like, have at it.
Okay, so. You know, we've kind of gone over everything on this slide already, but just to recap, path tracing requires a huge number of samples per pixel in order to get a good solution. And while we can use bias techniques like photon mapping to arrive at a solution faster, there's trade-offs involved in that. Bias techniques like photon mapping will have artifacting and blotches and numerical errors unless you use like, you know, a huge number of photons or whatever. And path tracing, it doesn't have any of that, of those types of errors, but the trade-off is that you have noise that you can only reduce by taking more samples per pixel. So for these reasons, very few production renders make use of CPU path tracing, because quite simply, it's not as it's not as efficient on the CPU as other techniques.
Connor, what are the heuristics for number of iterations? Like, how do I know how many iterations to take before my noise is reduced?
So that is directly dependent on how many lights you have in your scene, the size of the lights, how many different materials you have, what those material properties are, how many objects you have. There's like a huge number of factors that play into that. So that's actually an entire interesting field of research right now, which is when can you determine when you've taken enough samples inside of a path-traced image? And so far, the answer to that is there isn't really a good sort of set mathematical formula. Instead, what a lot of research is doing right now is running sort of like noise analysis on the image as it renders and determining when the image has reached a certain level of smoothness within some threshold and then just stopping the render. So path tracing, and that's sort of characteristic of all Monte Carlo techniques. Monte Carlo techniques don't really have a definite finishing point. They just converge closer and closer and closer and closer to the correct solution, and you have to pick some point to cut it off. So we know that implementing path tracers on the CPU can be rather slow. I want my path tracer to render faster. Is anybody else? Okay. Okay, so parallel path tracing. That's what the point of Project 2 is, right? Fortunately, much like ray tracing, path tracing is embarrassingly parallel. Like we mentioned, there's three whole levels that we can choose to parallelize this problem. And, you know, so it's very similar to ray tracing. And also similar to ray tracing, a naive path tracing implementation is purely recursive. But in order to implement it on the CPU, we're once again going to have to make it an iterative process. Fortunately, the steps for, like, the process for converting it into an iterative function, it's exactly the same as in the ray trace case. You turn it into a big while loop, and you store a couple of variables outside to track what's going on. So that should be very familiar. We're not going to go over that again, because you guys have already implemented that inside of your first homework. However, something that is a little different between the two, once again, like we mentioned, is that parallelizing by ray path for a path tracer is going to be significantly slower than parallelizing by ray. And that slowdown is going to be much greater than it would be inside of a ray tracer. So that's why I keep on coming back to this point, keep on hammering this point that if at all possible, you should try to parallelize by ray. because you're going to get fairly large performance boosts from that.
Okay, could you describe again like the difference between parallelizing by ray path and parallelization by just a ring?
Okay, yeah, sure. So I guess some of you guys might not have been here last time and aren't familiar with that. So
I was here, I'm gonna be here again.
Okay, sure. Okay, so when you have an image, a pixel bit that you're rendering, the most obvious way to parallelize this on the GPU is to just have one kernel for each pixel, right? And then for each pixel, you know, for each kernel, it'll take a pixel, it'll shoot a ray through that pixel into the scene, it'll bounce off of whatever objects, it'll go off into space or hit a light or whatever, and it'll return its color, and then that kernel will finish. Okay, so what happens in the case that one kernel has three bounces, but another kernel goes off into space, right? This kernel is done way ahead of this kernel. So this kernel is going to be, since we have to wait for all of these kernels to finish before we can launch the next batch, this kernel is going to be idling and wasting a lot of time while other kernels are still trying to finish their work. So because of this, we're actually wasting a lot of compute power. A lot of it's just sitting idle. And what we can do instead to deal with this problem is that instead of parallelizing by a pixel, instead we break it down into parallelizing each ray bounce. So instead of sort of like, basically like in the one case, you're treating it like, okay, you do one ray path, do a second ray path, do a third ray path, and so on and so forth. Whereas if we choose to parallelize it by ray, we'll say, okay, we'll do all the first bounces, then we'll do all the second bounces, then we'll do all the third bounces, and so on and so forth. And what and the advantage of doing this is that if you find that after the first bounce, you know, this path is done, doesn't need any more tracing, but these paths still need to go, what you can do is you can take the global, you can have like a global pool of rays, and you assign a kernel to each ray. And then when you find the rays inside of that pool no longer need to be traced in the next sort of step in its path, you cull it from that pool. You use string compaction to reduce that pool. And then that way, the next time when you launch all those kernels, you can make sure that every single kernel you're launching is doing work. And you don't have to wait for it to idle.
But we need to worry about this only when the number of rays is greater than the number of threads we have.
It will always be more, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, if we have more threads than the number of rays, then they won't be doing anything else anyway, right?
Yeah.
So they are still ready.
Yeah. The basic idea behind this is that for a single image, we can't just launch it all in one block. We need to launch it in multiple blocks. And we can only execute a certain number of blocks at a time. So if the number of blocks that we need to execute for one image is greater than the number of blocks we actually have hardware for, then this comes into play. But in the case where everything can fit it under one block, then yeah, it's like, doesn't matter. But, you know, that's kind of a really small image then, isn't it? It's like a 100 by 100 image or whatever it is on your graphics card. So if you want to...
I have two questions.
Yeah.
I want to ask you this in the lab as well. So, as far as path tracing is concerned, you will never have one ray giving off two rays.
No. In path tracing, there's no idea of, there's no concept of a shadow feeler. There's no concept of like the, because in ray tracing, when you do the refractive case, you send off two rays and you recurse on both of them at the same time. There's no concept of that in ray tracing. Or in path tracing. In path tracing, you're just randomly picking one case, following it, and then in the next iteration, you'll randomly pick another case and you'll follow it. And then you accumulate all of these results.
And the second question is where I think Patrick should also comment. Is there a way to calculate how many rays we have left without actually counting it by using stream compaction?
I don't know, Carl. I would say stream compaction is the way to go.
I would say
stream compaction. I don't know how many rays I have left, right? And I don't know what size to allocate for it, what size of memory to allocate.
Well, if you allocate however many that you have,
Yeah. You just won't fill the whole thing, but that's fine, but you'll know the upper bound at the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I agree with you that the memory consumption is not ideal because you'll have some wasted, yeah, but at least over time that will converge down for diver.
Yeah. I suppose if you really wanted to, you could do a linear scan and then like allocate a new array that's the proper size. Yeah.
That's my question. You know, all that wasted space, how can I just get rid of it?
Well, you could allocate something smaller with the scan, like you said. I don't know that.
Is that the only way to do it?
I did an atomic add, but I don't know. It might be slow, right? Because it does serialize.
Yeah, I'd have to profile it. I probably say that's going to be slower. Yeah. Depending on the hardware, too. On Fermi, the atomics are a little bit faster than they are on the original G80. But you guys all have 650s, apparently. So.
I think the second way I came up in a discussion with somebody in the lab was to give a global variable and use blocks, but would that be slower?
Right, that's exactly what he said. So with the atomics are not actually built on locks, they're built on atomic compare and swap.
Okay.
But I have a feeling that would be slower. I can't say definitely, like without, you know, running both or reading up on it more. I would say that you're okay with just allocating something the same size and stream compacting. If you're interested in exploring this more, I would say it's fair game as one of the extra things inside the project. So you're welcome to it. You can tell us the answer, and then we will be that much better to work with the following semester.
Yep. Yeah, those are really good questions. Okay, so is everybody clear on what ray parallelization is versus ray path? Everyone's good? Okay. Yeah, so we should parallelize by ray. Okay, so this is a fun sort of experiment for you guys to try at home if you want to. There's a very small sort of example path tracer called small PT CPU. And it's a small path tracer. It's like 99 lines of highly obfuscated, compressed C++ code. But it works. And then some guy who somehow decoded what all that meant ported it to OpenCL, and he built small PT GPU, which is a 99-line GPU OpenCL-based path tracer. It's not very useful for actual production use because, like, you know, the entire scene is hard-coded in and there's like bit hacking going on everywhere. But it's a good example because it's basically the same exact render but implemented on the CPU and on the GPU. So it's useful for doing performance comparisons. So if you want, go to these two links, download them, build them, run them, see for yourself how much faster the GPU one is. For me, the GPU one was between 10 to 100 times faster, and that was directly dependent on how good my graphics card was.
And your CPU as well. And your CPU.
And your CPU, yeah.
And the CPU implementation here is optimized, right? It's multi-threaded.
Yeah, it is multi-threaded.
Is it open the instructions too, though, do you know?
I don't think so.
Okay, yeah. It's still a multi-threaded, it's still the first.
Yeah, yeah, I believe it uses OpenMP just to do the like for loop parallelization.
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, these are the kind of two sample renders I got out of that. These are both after 63 seconds of running. The small CPU one still has a lot of noise, still has a lot of variance, but the GPU one is basically completely converged and smooth. So, that's...
Well, Kostik has said a separate rays after the fact, in path tracer.
No, in a path tracer, you don't have to.
No.
You may refract and then...
You refract once, and then you refract again. So, if you have a really simple case, this is a sphere, this is a light source, this is the ground, right? So a rays will hit the surface, refract through, hit there, go to your camera. And that's all your caustic is coming from. And that's where you get the little highlight. Yeah, so it's just acting like a magnifying lens. And that's the nice thing about path tracing, you don't have to worry about doing special stuff. Because I know in photon mapping, that does have to, caustics do have to be treated as a second pass, but in path tracing, you don't have to worry about it. Although, something to note is that caustics will take a long time to converge, because they have a tendency to be very small. Anything that's small in path tracing means that it has a lower probability of being hit by rays, simply by, you know, simply because of its smallness, and the less probability it has of being hit by a ray that's randomly bouncing around, then the less probability it is that it'll be sampled, which means the more samples, it'll take more samples to fully, like, represent it, which means it'll take longer for that to converge. This is why a room full of really small point lights in path tracing is a really bad scenario. Okay, so let's say that you've implemented your path tracer on the GPU, and it's going pretty fast now. It's much faster than the CPU, but I want my path tracer to render faster still. Okay, so we should look at actually, you know, evaluating what's the most expensive part of the algorithm then. And maybe that's where we can begin looking at where we can further optimize on the GPU. So does anybody have a guess at what the most expensive part of this algorithm is? Exactly. It's your intersection testing. And some people will argue that, oh, the expensive part is the BSDF, because the BSDF, depending on how it's sending off your ray, that'll, you know, determine how many bounces your ray will take. Well, how costly that is still directly dependent on how many intersection tests you have to do. The more bounces you have, the more intersection tests. So this is where all of our compute is going, and this is where a lot of our compute is also getting wasted. Because if you think about, okay, we'll go into that. So we're going to talk about spatial acceleration structures in order to deal with this problem. Specifically, we're going to look at KD trees and implementing stackless KD trees on the GPU. Okay, so let's say that we want to cast a ray into a scene, and we find the nearest object, and we want to find the nearest object that the ray intersects. What is the easiest way to do this? It's probably how all of you guys did it inside of your ray tracer, which is fine for a small scene. Iterate through all the objects, yeah. Loop through every object, intersection test all of them, return the closest one. What if you have 100 million triangles? Okay, so this gets really expensive really, really quickly, because you have to intersection test for every single one of those 100 million triangles. And only one of those intersection tests is actually important, right? Because only one of them is actually going to return the triangle that we care about, which means all 99 million some tests that aren't that one test are all wasted. So they're effectively wasted computation time. So,
or find a good stopping point, and then you can continue
okay.
On one day.
Okay, I guess we'll quickly go over. Okay, yeah, no, we're all stopped. Okay, so the solution to this problem is space partitioning. Basically, figuring out a way to represent where everything is located in space so that for a given point in space, we can find all the objects that are closest to that point. And similarly, for a given ray, we can find all of the objects that are close to that ray. Yeah. Okay, so we'll go over two ways that are not very good for doing it, and then we'll save the good stuff for next time. So the most obvious, naive way to do this is uniform grid partitioning. We'll split our entire scene into a uniform voxel grid. We'll figure out what objects overlap with what voxels, and we'll store those object IDs inside of those voxels, right? Sounds really simple. So, and then, you know, when we want to traverse through this entire scene and we want to find what's closest, we'll just figure out what voxels we're hitting through ray marching, and for each voxel, we'll figure out what objects are in it, and we'll do the intersection test, and we're done. That seems really simple, right? Anybody cool with that? Okay. So, there are a couple of problems with this approach. First off, the memory bound can get out of hand very quickly because it's directly proportional to the scene size, the resolution of the grid. As a lot of you guys probably found with the volume renderer from 460, when you have a really large voxel grid, your memory use gets out of hand really quickly. Because let's say you're storing 2 or 3 floats per voxel, and you have 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000 voxels. That's a ton of memory. But even that actually isn't the largest problem, because you can always just get more memory. A bigger problem is that there's two types of scenarios where the uniform grid wastes a lot of space. So the first one is called the teapot in a stadium. Imagine you have a football stadium, and you have a teapot in the middle, and those are the only two objects in your scene. So the vast majority of your voxel grid is just empty space, and finding that teapot is really hard, because that teapot is so small. And the second type of problem where voxel grids are useless is called the angry mob in a stadium type scenario. So it's, you know, let's say you have, this is your scene, and you divide it into your uniform voxel grid. What if all your geometry is clustered in this single voxel? Then your voxel grid is not useful, because every time that you hit this, you're still intersection testing against every single object. Okay, and then finally, there's the question of what happens if an object spans multiple voxels in this grid. What if we have a giant object that takes like all this space, and we have an array that goes through like this, right? We're going to be, for every voxel that we go through that this object overlaps with, we're going to intersection test that object over and over again. So we only need one intersection test, but we are doing many. Okay, so this is not a very good approach. So we can kind of alleviate some of the problems with the uniform grid by allowing cells to be hierarchically subdivided into an octree. So, you know, if you have a cell that has an object in it, you can divide it into four smaller cells to get more detail. And, you know, that quite efficiently deals with this angry mob in a football stadium case. But once again, there's problems with this. How exactly you're supposed to traverse it isn't really clear anymore, because you can't just remarch it, because your remarch step no longer is guaranteed to always go through one voxel, because your voxel sizes are variant. And then also, constructing the octree can take a long time, because you have to recurse over and over again to continuously refine dense areas until you reach some threshold for when you want to stop doing that. Okay, so these are two possible approaches, but they're not quite right. But they are thinking along the right path, which is that we want a way to subdivide space so that we can know what objects are in a given subsection of our space. So what we'll start looking at, what we'll look at next time is the idea of a KD tree, which is the correct solution to this problem.
For static scenes, this is the current state of the art as far as I know.
Yeah.
And then for dynamic scenes, usually bounded volume hierarchy.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have covered or not. It's okay, we're not covering it.
Okay, yeah. I guess since we all have a little more time, I can touch on it on Monday, yeah. But for the purpose of a static scene, a KD tree is the way to go.
Well, thanks for staying a little bit after, guys. Please start on this project, and we'll see you Monday.
Yeah, thank you, guys. And thanks for the good questions.
Yeah, very, very nice job.